I'm Christopher Lydon, pulling the electronic neighborhood. It was a puzzle 20 years ago when personal computers hooked up by modem. It's an open question still in web world, and here it is. How do you start an electronic conversation? Who's in on it? What shall we talk about? And when does this virtual circle of ours graduate from chat room to community? The Well was an early answer that's a legend now. Well, W-E-L-L stood for Whole Earth Electronic Link, and it became a group household for thousands of people. A sort of pub where everyone knew your name. An intimate network of solitary correspondents, lots of them in their underwear in the dead of night typing their hearts out to invisible friends. They fell in love and clawed each other cruelly. They held deadhead reunions and they argued how the mind works. Virtual communities, like this one you're in on, are next as the conversation continues. Audio streaming provided by New England Streaming Media. Underwriting came from ENA Eric Nelson Architects, providing creative solutions for living and working on the web at ena-ma.com, and from Gail Leander Public Relations, helping authors publicize their progressive books. Contact glpr at aol.com, and from Suzanne and Bob Petrucci. I'm Christopher Lydon. Tom Mandel found a community online that he didn't have in real life. He fell in love, then out of love, then he got sick with lung cancer, and he shared his dying with a few thousand of his closest friends. That community was called The Well. It started out in 1985 as a club or salon for smart counterculturalists, the early baby boomers, and it grew into a vital place in discussion forums about books, parenting, sexuality, the Grateful Dead, and science fiction. And then it grew more intimate with true confessions and real-life get-togethers. Our guest Katie Hafner has told the story of the first online neighborhood in her book called The Well. It's a story about loners in cyberspace before we even knew about cyberspace, and it's another great tale about the hype and the promise of the internet. Our phone is 617-450-2923. How's your life online? Who are you out there, and who are you in this online community? Be a witness at 617-450-2923. Welcome, Katie Hafner. It's a wonderful book. The Well met any definition you want of a community in the sense that it was a network of memory and love and loss. It was a place where people felt whole and lived and died. How did it happen, Katie?
Well, it's the creation, the co-creation of Stuart Brand of Whole Earth Catalog fame. I'm sure you've heard of Stuart, real legend, a real national treasure, I've decided.
Three jumps ahead of the rest of us.
You're not kidding. You never know what's going to come out of Stuart's brain. And then Larry Brilliant. It was actually Larry Brilliant's idea. Larry Brilliant, this was back in 1984. They were having lunch one day in La Jolla. They were at a conference together. And Larry is a physician who had become an entrepreneur. And he, in his own way, is a very creative, brilliant man, to coin a word. And he and Stuart sat down, and Larry said he had this idea for starting this online thing. They certainly weren't using the word community at the time. That came later. It was an experiment. An online social experiment is probably how they were phrasing it.
Sort of putting fairly early computers onto a telephone exchange, in effect, and coordinating it with a VAX computer, which would seem very primitive by today's standards.
Right.
That was the idea. But then what was the goal? Was it to make $1 trillion? Was it to form a club?
Well,
or just see what happened?
Well, Larry was a businessman, but that was secondary. The idea was to throw these people together, like-minded people. You know, mind you, these were people in the Bay Area. Remember that back then, we're talking, you know, early, mid-80s, when having a personal computer was a big deal, much less a modem. And so that was But that was sort of from the outset, sort of self-selecting. And then it was kind of the whole earth crowd, you know. These were people in their, you know, sort of approaching middle age, sort of leftover hippies who all sort of thought about the same things in the same way and had a lot to say. And so the idea, Larry's brilliant stroke, was to recruit Stewart's crowd, because he knew that there would be something there. They wouldn't just sit around and talk about, I don't know, the weather or
lower back pain or something. Or,
well, actually, they talked a lot about things like that. But they also, right away, what's interesting about The Well is that it caught on pretty much right away, even with very small numbers, because of some of the early conferences that were started. And, you know, we should, at the outset, I should probably explain that this is not chat. It was not chat. It's very different from that.
Draw the line.
Well, it's this thing called threaded discussion. Mm-hmm. And this was very much governed by the software.
We have it on our site, Galore. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, yeah. And it's asynchronous. Which means that you type what you want to say, then you hit a button, which means it gets posted, and people read it, and then they respond. Mm. And what's very important about that is that you have time to take a breath, or many breaths, or you can wait 3 minutes or 3 days before responding to what gets posted, which makes it all very considered. And chat is, as people know, with real-time chat, which tends to be sort of more like anonymous sex, it's very different. It's just got a very different tone and sort of urgency to it, and it tends to be more superficial. I'm talking about chat now. So what this did with the threaded discussions is that it really raised the bar for what got said, and people really rose to the occasion, because these were people who really valued their own minds, and they liked.
I want to just boast a little bit that on our own website, christopherlydon.org,
yes,
it's amazing what flowers, satirists, poets, limerick writers, every kind of parodist, wits, generous, good, interesting people. Before we get to the people on The Well, though, I want you to spell out some of the rules of the game. They were quite specific. There were categories called conferences. You had to own up to your own words. There was no anonymity. Which of those Well rules do you think were crucial?
Well, I think we have Stewart to thank for most of these. Not for the software called PicoSpan so much, but for this whole idea of accountability, which I think was absolutely crucial, because, again, drawing the analogy with chat, which can be anonymous, accountability meant that people knew who you were, and that made you accountable for what you said. And the counterpart to that was this wonderful thing he coined, which was you own your own words, which has become legendary. It's now people sort of think it means something, has something to do with copyright, which it doesn't, but it's more that you write that and you've said it and you're accountable for what you've said. And it made people very conscious and very responsive.
Right. It didn't eliminate flaming, but it, at least you knew exactly who the flamers were, and it was their words. I want to introduce Howard Rheingold, who's on the line. He was early member of The Well, who kind of earned his way with the first post describing tarantula sex. But then he started a conference called The Mind on How the Mind Works. He's the author of The Virtual Community, Homesteading on the Electronic Frontier. Howard Rheingold, what did it teach you? In what ways did it surprise you?
It surprised me because there was, in 1985, long before The Well connected to the Internet, an entire culture having a high old time creating their own entertainment. You know, we have lived in a world where we buy our experiences packaged by big corporations which broadcast them to us. We were both the audience and the creators of the content, and I think part of Stewart's genius was to let the inmates run the asylum. We could create a mind conference, and if we wanted to create a brain conference to talk about something slightly different, we could do that as well.
It got wacky at times. Tell us about it.
Well, you know, there is not a clear differentiation between fun and serious when you can go to the fun conference and tell a joke and then simply go over through the virtual boundary to a more serious conference and talk about health or parenting. So it created a somewhat more fluid boundary between the different parts of our identities. We're used to being one person at work and right. one person at home and one person on the street. Here we could switch between those very rapidly, and that was in itself great fun because it was a medium that afforded something that humans can do but previous media did not really support.
Howard Rheingold and Katie Hafner, I wish you'd both talk about Tom Mandel, who is this kind of gloriously flawed hero of the book. He lived, he loved, he hated, and he died on the well. What sort of a person was it that needed that place so badly, so peculiarly, so uniquely?
Well, I'd actually like to hear Howard talk about that, because Howard knew Tom. I never met Tom. Howard, what do you think?
Well, I did know Tom intimately. In fact, I spoke at his funeral, and I felt obliged by truth and by nature of Tom when I spoke at his funeral to say, well, you know, we all loved Tom, and we all knew that part of Tom was that he could be a tremendous jerk. So part of Tom's personality was that he was many kinds of people. That started with the fact that he was, although many people call themselves a futurist, he was actually a paid futurist for a think tank, SRI International, and they paid him pretty well to provide information for their professional clients about what might happen in the future. But behind that door in his SRI office, he was very often logged onto the well, having all kinds of unofficial fun. Now, the interesting thing about that was while he was selling his time and his insights for a lot of money to his clients, he was giving it away to us for free. And if you multiply that by a lot of people like Katie and myself who have expertise, which we offer professionally for money, but kind of gave to each other in this gift economy because you put 10 cents in and you get a dollar out that way. That was extremely part of the magic. When Tom and I discovered each other, we had never met in person, but online we were doing all kinds of things. In fact, one night we decided to start the True Confessions Conference, in which nobody could comment on what anyone else said, but everyone could confess something. And for some reason, it just exploded. Eventually, I did meet Tom and got to know him, and then there were some incidents that Katie outlines very well.
Let's talk about it. Tom Mandel met and fell in love with a woman called Nana in the well. He trashed her, fell out of love, rather disgraced himself on her account, eventually fell in love with her again and married her before he died. Does that happen in real life or only online?
Well, it's important to note here, just a point of correction, is that they did not meet on the well. They knew each other before Nana got on the well. In fact, what was very interesting is that they had offices right next to each other at SRI, and she noticed he was doing a lot of work on his computer. She heard all this click clacking and the white noise of the modem, and she got curious and she asked him what he was doing. This was when they were seeing each other. And he kind of grumbled at her because it was his almost private secret life without her. But then she, being the industrious person that she is, she went and hauled a modem out of the closet at SRI, and she figured out how to get on, and she popped up on the well and she said, "Hi, here I am." And he grumbled something like, "Oh, there goes the neighborhood." And So they were so they had a very physical relationship physically in the real world before they were together on the well. In fact, when they were on the well together, they did not advertise their attachment, which I found interesting. But
do you
then,
mean to say that were they lovers before the well?
Yes, that's what I'm saying, and I think that's an important just
I didn't, okay. I
historic
that.
Note to make. People tend to miss that, and maybe I didn't make it clear enough in the book. In fact, as my editor was editing the book, he missed it, so I tried to make it even clearer in the book. But in any case, then they had a falling out. Nana got sick with breast cancer, and Tom sort of wasn't there for her. That's the best way I can put it. And they had gotten engaged, and then they broke that off. And that then it became, it sort of bled over onto the well. And he took a lot of things out on her on the well. In fact, was kind of stalking her on the well. And this was extremely upsetting to her. She was sick. And he was playing this odd anger out toward her on the well. And this is where his, I don't know if Howard would agree with me on this point, but this was where his personality began to kind of split, where he was going to work and sort of, you know, getting dressed in the morning, going to work, doing his job at SRI, gave people at SRI no hint that this was happening. And then on the well, he was losing it.
Howard, you saw it unfold on the well. What did you make of it? I mean, it's also, I think, a sort of caution against getting sentimental about these relationships. I mean, in this case, the spirit of the well got invasive, hounding, I mean, semi-savage.
Well, I think that that's a danger of getting sentimental about any kind of community. Certainly, these things happen in any group of people, and if they don't happen, that's, I think, a sign that the communication among that group of people is probably somewhat shallow. They're holding something back. It was a very divisive event for the community because people were somewhat forced to choose up sides. And by doing that, that certainly infuriated Tom, and he had a whole bag of tricks to play on people, and including having all kinds of secret accounts and all kinds of back doors into the well. He got thrown off the well and thrown back. He came back under a different name. It was really quite a circus. And we ceased being friends for a while. Or Tom really cut me off for a while and became friendly again when he was sick and dying, and of course then that was a much more serious game.
There was no, in the technology and even in the spirit of the community, there was no real effort to pull these combatants apart.
Well, there was a lot of effort to pull them apart, but Tom had all of these secret accounts and kept getting thrown off for his behavior, and he kept coming back on. And I think it's probably outside of the scope of this discussion or Katie's book. They were both playing a lot of games with each other that they were not really disclosing to others. So they were in a sense making puppets out of the community. None of us really knew the whole story.
And let me just jump in here.
Go for it.
Because Howard brings up a really important point, which I think is essential to this or any online community, which is that when Howard says that they were playing games with each other sort of offline that people online didn't know about, what people online had to work with was just what they knew. And so where were they to go with that? You know, it was they had a finite amount of information about what was happening. It was very damaging to the community at the time because Mandel, what we should mention is that Mandel erased a bunch of topics in a real rage, went and erased a bunch of stuff on the well and, you know, obliterated a big part of the well's history and, which was not to be recovered. And so, so there was all this stuff happening offline, but all people saw what was, those who didn't really know them very well offline, saw what was happening online, and it's sort of a limiting, it limits, it makes it in a way, an artificial world, but it also makes you wonder what isn't in its way an artificial world. You know, I've done a lot of thinking about, you know, what if this had happened in a small town?
Exactly.
You know, people,
it does.
People still. It does.
Katie, have to stand by. I want to thank Howard Rheingold, but also introduce Amy Jo Kim, who runs a design studio specializing in new web communities. She's written a book called Community Building on the Web. Amy Jo Kim, in your big picture, what was the well an example of? And who's doing it now?
Well, I think the well was and still is an example of a community that's built around shared conversations. And it's really the preeminent example of that. And it really came into birth, as Howard and Katie explained, and as they know so well, at a special time in our cultural development, a time when it was really only the very cutting-edge early adopter people who were getting on it. And that really shaped its culture, along with the Stuart Brand crowd.
Put it in the context of all kinds of shared conversations, though. I mean, quite seriously, some of the conversations at the town dump get pretty deep and pretty regular,
right.
Pretty important. There are church groups. There are poker playing groups.
Let me jump on that. The point I want to make is that a conversation is one kind of activity that people can have online, and I think one of the biggest changes that's happening now, and that's really driving the development of a much wider variety of web communities, is that not all communities are built around conversations. A lot of the communities we're seeing now, the conversation is part of what people are doing, but it really wraps around another activity. For example, you can go to Amazon and shop for books and electronics,
right.
And then there's conversations that are very structured that have to do with people reviewing those items,
right.
And sharing their opinions. You can go to eBay and trade, you know, bid and trade and collect, you know, get your collectibles, buy your computer parts. There are conversations that happen at eBay as well, but those conversations are built around the activity, the shared activity. And the reason that this is happening now, and it wasn't happening when the well was born, is that the Internet is developing and evolving and getting more sophisticated. More people are online. A wider variety of people are online. And so what we have now is really an explosion of much more specialized communities. Yes, there are still communities that are built around free-form conversations like the well, but more and more we're seeing communities that are focused around a more specific purpose, that have a little bit more structure to them. And I think that's
For example, and the question is, I mean, do you lose the humanity when you narrow the focus?
No, I think that's like saying, do you lose the humanity when you talk to someone on the telephone versus in person? The Internet is really more and more, it's not this other thing. It's becoming integrated into our lives. It's becoming integrated into our other media, like the telephone and the television. It's really just another way for people to communicate and collaborate and make connections with other people.
But a lot of online communities would kill for the intimacy that the well had, and maybe it was the small size too, relatively speaking. What can they learn from the well?
Well, I have my opinion. I'd love to hear what Katie and Howard think as well. I can tell you what I've personally learned from the well as a designer and as someone
Sure.
working in the field. There are several key things. One, the well, Howard mentioned this before, the well, it's certainly not anybody can create any conference. There is some structure to it. But the well really fosters self-determination in these small groups. And I think that there are levels of self-determination, and there are levels of permissions and checks and balances. Yes, anybody that's a full-fledged member can create an independent conference. Anybody who's really proven themselves can be invited, or almost anybody can be invited to be a host of a public conference. It has some levels of permissions that's very analogous to what you might see in any small town in terms of earning the right to have some privileges, to have some power, and then also having the mechanism in place to rescind that right if people abuse that power. You know, Katie talks about that a lot in her book. That's part of the story, is, you know, how you grapple with that. And I think that's something the well very much pioneered. I also think there are many things that to learn from the well for what not to do. I personally really think that communities are strongest when they have some core purpose that bring people together. The people on the well really got to create their own purpose, and that was a very powerful thing. But I think the well in some ways is languishing at this point. And part of that is because getting together to talk is a great thing, but it also wears thin after a while in terms of, well, why are we here? Mm-hmm. Why is this worth our time? What are we talking about? It doesn't mean it's not valid. It doesn't mean that it doesn't meet the needs of many people. But what I see and what I've learned is the power of having a little bit more structure and a little bit more direction for a given community.
Katie Hafner, why did the well get overripe? It was bought and sold a couple of times, managed by different folk. There were dissident groups. Some people left. It got too big and then too small. What's left of it?
Well, too big and too small are relative terms. I mean, remember, at its height, it was like 11,000 people versus the 20-something million people on AOL. But can we put a bookmark there just for a sec?
Sure.
I just want to go back to what Amy Jo said about community and Amazon and those eBay. And, you know, this has really got me thinking lately about what is a community. And I'm wondering, and I'm just throwing this out as a question, is, you know, have we commodified the word community so that, see, my thinking about community is that, and this is why I keep coming back to the idea of a small town, it's a place in which people have an investment and a stake. And mm-hmm. and I am not convinced. I remain to be convinced, but I'm not yet convinced that a place like Amazon fits that description.
Members of our own community want to get in on the conversation. The phone is 617-450-2923. Dan is on the line from Metro West.
Hi there, Chris.
Welcome, Dan.
Good to hear your voice.
Is this our Dan?
Webcast.
Okay, man.
Congratulations on number 10. I'm the guy that wants to go by the name of Dr. Dan on your BBSs.
A brilliant writer.
I have a question also I want to give my compliments to Howard Rheingold on the book, They Have a Word for It. I'm really enjoying that. I've been part of web communities for quite a while, and have also tried to install them in corporations. I've only seen one active successful corporation, BBS within a corporation, and that was within DEC, based on a predecessor of Lotus Notes.
Hmm.
It grew up early in the company's culture and about the same time as email, but filled a different niche. And it became central to the performance of the company. Since the advent of the web...
What was the purpose of it inside the company, Dan?
Pardon me?
What was the purpose inside the company?
Oh, it was lots of different purposes. There was... A purposeless place, basically, to have fun. And then there were a lot of work-related conferences where people from all over the world came to share ideas and to compare notes and to basically build a project together. But the question that I'm getting to is, if you're trying to install one of these things inside a corporation, as I have, oftentimes you come up against the email culture. You know, like, we have Outlook. Why would we need anything else? How do people get around that block and convince people of the utility of a groupware, a web-based community inside a corporation to get business problems done?
That's, interesting question.
The root of it.
Amy Jo Kim, do you want to take a crack at it?
Sure. I do a lot of work with corporations that are in exactly that situation. It's a great question. You know, I don't think there's one simple answer to that. I think it really depends on the situation. Sometimes what I've found is... you go with it. I have personally seen corporations that were very email-based try and install Lotus Notes, and I've seen it fail miserably. There are a number of new tools that take advantage of email culture and amplify on people's uses of email rather than trying to replace it. That's one way to approach it. Sometimes I've found that's the right way. Another way to approach it is to find a very small group of people that actually need the thing that you're offering, the communication you're offering, and create a small success with those group of people that you can showcase, and then use that to get the ball rolling in a larger arena. But starting small is always a good idea.
Fascinating. Dan, thank you for the question. Thanks for your interest online at ChristopherLydon.org. Amy Jo Kim, thank you for joining us. And we'll be back after a short break. We're talking about the peculiar vitality of online communities. They have their downsides, too. They also have nasty folk in them who can drive almost anybody away. We're talking about The Well, which was maybe the first real online neighborhood. We'll be back after a short break. Audio streaming was provided by New England Streaming Media. Underwriting came from Pagito Systems Group, specializing in Java and Linux-based multi-tier application development, www.pagito.com, and by Align Incorporated, a Boston-area Java engineering and consulting firm, and from Elsa Dorfman, Boston's Matthew Brady. Details available at elsa.photo.net. I'm Christopher Lydon. We're talking about The Well, a legendary online community starting in 1984 in the Bay Area of California, remembered now as a sort of first great electronic neighborhood, community, if you will. Katie Hafner of the New York Times wrote the book. Amy Jo Kim wrote Community Building on the Web. Omar Wasow joins us. He is the executive director of BlackPlanet.com, a website with 2.5 million registered users, the most anywhere, he says. Omar, we're talking about what makes a community a community. I think it was Amy's definition that unlike eBay or Amazon.com or AOL.com or whatever, a real community needs an investment and a stake among its members. Do your members have that? Omar?
Yeah, I think clearly the audience has to have an investment and a sort of a shared common interest, a shared passion for each other and you know, to bring the group together. But I think there's another element which is essential, which is that people have to be talking to each other, and that while on Amazon there are people posting reviews of books and on eBay there are people transacting, each of which has a kind of democratic kind of audience participatory quality. Hmm. People aren't really talking to each other, and that's really what distinguishes our site from.
Talk about it. What's the shared passion in BlackPlanet.com?
Well, it varies from person to person, but the core idea is that ethnic identity is a very powerful organizing principle in people's lives. People, whether they're children or, you know, parents trying to raise kids or people looking to date or people thinking about what job to go to, are interested in having conversations with other African Americans about those issues. And so there are a wide number of topics that our members come to talk to each other about. And also, you know, I mean, it's also just a social hangout. So people like to come and have fun and flirt and make friends and network professionally.
Do you have conferences like The Well did? I mean, sort of play areas, so to speak?
Well, there are specific topic discussion areas which are a little more structured, where we've said here are a bunch of topics that that people can talk about. There are also what we have, what we call clubs, where people can set up their own discussion topics. There also is an enormous amount of completely unstructured interaction, which is just individual people talking to each other without any facilitation by us at all.
What do they talk about? And I wonder, what's the mood? What's the music, so to speak, the politics, the spirit?
Yeah, I mean, I guess the core, in terms of the spirit, the thing that we really try to emphasize is that most of the web is like walking around a library by yourself. It's a very solitary kind of informational experience. And while I love to read a book and to be alone, I also like to be at a cafe or a nightclub and have a kind of lively hustle and bustle kind of atmosphere. And that's really what we've tried to create on Black Planet. So, for example, when you come to the login page of Black Planet, you'll see something that you see on very few websites, which is that we have a ticker that says there are, at any given moment, you know, if you look, you go right now, you'll see there are 32,432 people online right now.
Wow.
And that kind of information has the value of making you feel like you're not alone at this site. This is a site that's really got some activity on it, and that ticker's constantly changing, so it really feels like the site is alive.
You're in Yankee Stadium with 35,000 of your very, very best friends, and then what?
Well, and then the trick is how easily are you able to find the subgroup within that 35,000 that really matches your interests. So we have lots of tools that we've developed to allow members to find each other. So the simple math is, when you register for the site, you have to fill out a very detailed profile, which creates basically your identity, your citizenship within the community. And then other members can say, you know, I'm looking for somebody in New York who likes tennis. And we have search tools that allow you to find those other people. The other thing that people do is just browse through the profiles and are constantly kind of in this sort of serendipitous way stumbling upon people with whom they have a common interest. And then because we've made it really easy to communicate, we built, again, a whole suite of technologies that allow you to send an email, which is, lots of sites allow you to send an email, but we make everything sort of one click away. And so it's very simple to instant message, send what we call a note, or sign somebody's guest book. And all of those things create connections between people. So we're really, our key focus is to facilitate relationships between members of the audience.
The numbers are mind-boggling, as well as the flexibility of this tool. What's the history of BlackPlanet.com? How long have you been doing it?
I've been wanting to do an online community focused on African Americans since I graduated from Stanford in 1992, and sort of the ideas evolved over time. I launched an online community called New York Online, which was focused on New York and very multicultural, and was working with magazines like Vibe and Essence, which had large readership.
Unbelievable volume of traffic, and we can target that traffic. the wealth charged from the beginning. More than you're doing, Omar. Do you charge? Amy, does this sound promising to you as a venture? Sure does to me.
You know, time will tell. I wish you tons of luck, Omar. I was actually part of the founding team of Net Noir, so I went through this kind of cycle, and I know how difficult it is. You know, Yahoo's struggling, as we all know. I wish you lots of luck. I think it's going to be tough. I don't see that particular business model as one that is going to be successful moving forward for a lot of companies. There may be some exceptions.
Why not?
Black Planet may be one of them. Before I answer that, though, I want to cycle back. There's been a couple of big misconceptions that have gotten said, and I want to correct them. One, it's a big misconception to say people aren't talking on either Amazon or eBay. Amazon does have message boards, and they're quite active.
Right. No.
Anyway, the point is, eBay, yes, the conversation is not the goal, but it wraps around. And the thing about eBay, I worked with eBay for a year. I know them very, very well. The thing about eBay that if you just look at the site, you would never understand is the depth and richness of both the conversations and the communities that are there. The word community is very sticky. It's got a lot of different definitions depending how you look at it. It's like the blind man and the elephant. But by any definition, which is, you know, people forming a connection, being important in each other's lives, helping each other out, having an ongoing relationship where they get to know each other better over time, eBay has a number of very rich communities. So overall, eBay is not a community. It's a collection of people that are looking to buy and sell things. However, the interesting point about eBay that most people don't realize is that where the conversation is happening, the rich, dynamic, really get to know you and help you out conversation is not on the site. Where it's happening is through email. After people buy and sell, or the brilliance of eBay, one of the many brilliant things about it, is that it really forces people to send email back and forth and to negotiate and to have a conversation that way in order to close the deal. And so but through that, many, many people have met others who share their interests. They have ongoing conversations with them. Some of them take place on the eBay boards. Some of them take place on sites that surround eBay, kind of like eBay fan sites. A lot of them take place through mailing lists. Numerous people have signed others up for their private little collectors' mailing lists, doll collectors, coin collectors, all kinds of things. So I want to just make I think this is an important point moving into the future, which is, again, it goes to the fact that the web is not this separate thing necessarily. I'm sure on Omar's side and certainly on the well, people get together offline as well. There are a lot of different tools and mechanisms that we all have at our disposal for connecting with people, for staying in touch. And a website is one place to either make that connection or keep that connection going, but that connection will then manifest itself not just on that website but in myriad ways.
Amy Jo, I want to ask Omar a sort of a black thing question about Black Planet. .com. And you're talking about selling Mercedes-Benz to an African-American market. You're talking about dating services. I mean, there are a lot of kinds of magazines that fill that niche. But I also wonder what you learn as an African-American about the country, Black America. What would the civil rights movement make of BlackPlanet.com and what's going on there? What would Jesse Jackson, what would Colin Powell, what would George W. Bush see? What would we all see about Black America on your...
I have no idea what Jesse Jackson would see, but what I know has been a source of great joy for me has been that the sort of diversity within the black community mm-hmm. has sort of exploded forth. So much as on the internet you see all of these sort of quirky individuals sort of have a platform to express themselves, so too on Black Planet have we given our members fairly simple but nevertheless powerful publishing tools that allow the enormous heterogeneity within the black community to be represented. And so I think for me, one of the big joys of sort of launching Black Planet and seeing it evolve is that where in traditional media you will see kind of the one black voice representing this enormously complicated and diverse group of people, on Black Planet you really can sort of begin to suss out all of the variety within the community. And you'll see that sometimes, you know, in simple things like we'll do a poll, and where the conventional wisdom is black people feel this way, and that's sort of how both mainstream black and white press will reflect it, you'll see on our site that there's really much more difference of opinion within the community. You also will see, you know, on people's personal pages, just sort of, you know, all manner of interest and again, passion. And I think that, to me, is a very powerful message about the fundamental sort of humanity and complexity of black people, as opposed to the kind of cookie-cutter version you usually get in mass media.
Omar Wasso, stand by. I want to introduce Sherry Turkle, who's been studying, she's teaches sociology at MIT, and she's been studying sort of identity and who we become online from the beginning. Are we our real selves online, Sherry Turkle, or does something else happen? I mean, Omar has just been talking about different portrayals, self-portrayals of African America online. How do we explain this?
Well, I want to get back to the question of that Katie raised about what we mean by community and whether or not we've commodified the word. In some of the examples that have been spoken about today, I think you could say that they're not so much communities of it's not so much an investment in community as an investment in content. People want to get to know each other one-to-one, to sell to each other one-to-one, to go on to make a date one-to-one. That's quite different from, I think, where you began in The Well and in some of the virtual communities that I studied, the MUDs, the MOOs, where really people had an investment in the social life of the community itself. So I think that one of the answers to your question is it depends what kind of community you're joining. If you're in a community where you're a stakeholder in the kind of ongoing town square mm-hmm. that the community represents, you project a very different kind of identity than if you're there to buy, to sell, to get off, and to, you know, make a friend online, potentially to make a date. These are different kinds of things. I think the richness of where we are today on the web is that there's room for all of these different things. But the difference between emails that start off the platform of buying and selling on eBay and the kind of great good place, town square feeling mm-hmm. that you got on the Well, and that I think allowed for some of that really community feeling to develop. I think these are important distinctions.
Well, people argue about this. I mean,
yes,
what kind of weak or strong links these are compared, say, to
absolutely,
you know, the links among Little League parents or volunteer fire departments or, again, you know, a regular bridge group.
Yes.
What's the strongest kind of community you see online?
And
what are the pseudos?
I think the strongest kind of community, and what the Well was, although it hasn't been emphasized too much in this conversation, is that it was both a physical and a virtual community. I mean, Katie talked about how that love affair started offline, migrated online, came back offline.
Exploded online.
The strongest links happen when people use the virtual to leverage the power of the virtual to increase their contacts in the physical. The Well had...
Give an example.
The Well had parties, and people got together face-to-face. These people knew each other. And then they continue those relationships online. In Blacksburg, Virginia, it's a community that's completely wired up, so people start political activism online and then bring it into their offline communities. The Seattle Community Network is certainly another virtual community that's trying to make the links between offline politics and what you can organize online. And I think this is stakeholding of a different mm-hmm. kind, because you're using what online is great for, which is forging connections across time, across space, getting people of similar interests together to not just do things in the virtual, but to make things happen in our physical communities. And I think
what
that...
What does the Seattle Community Network accomplish?
The Seattle Community, the Blacksburg, Virginia one, or...
You said Seattle, either one.
These are, for example, if you have, if you want to start, if you're in a poor neighborhood and you want to start a prenatal, you want some prenatal instruction, you get together with other people in your neighborhood or a child care collective, you can get together with other people in your mm-hmm. neighborhood and create a kind of bulletin board to set up something in your neighborhood. So you get together with people online because it makes it easy for you to access your neighbors very quickly, but then you get together with people offline to make the thing happen.
Omar Wasso, do you want to guess how people use blackplanet.com offline?
Well, we know that's a great point, and I think Sherry's exactly right that they're strongest when you sort of integrate the offline and the online. We were confident that Black Planet would be successful in part because we were building on the strength of a real-world community, not a sort of theoretical abstract community. We also did a survey on the site. We found that 56% of our members had met other members offline, so a huge number compared with most people's experiences of the web. And again, the kinds of things people are doing are making friends, dating, going for job interviews. I was at a conference recently, and somebody came up to me and said, "Oh, I'm so grateful for Black Planet. I just moved to the city, and I didn't know anybody, and tonight I'm going to the museum with three other members I met through Black Planet." And that's the kind of hybrid online and offline experience that I think really grounds people and connects people to that community and that site.
I'd like to ask Omar about political participation, because in one of the studies that I did, people who consider themselves very politically active online didn't vote. In other words, there's a danger, I think, that online, quote, activism is somehow taking people away from real-life activism. And I'm wondering if in his community, what he sees the balance as there.
Well, there's a recurring critique by folks, from all stripes of persuasion, that sort of the net becomes this thing that disconnects you from the real world. And I think that, there clearly are some very hard, real examples of that. But my sense of how a site like ours works is that we're really sort of taking you away from television, which is in a lot of ways a profoundly passive medium, and plugging you into this whole social network. I can't speak to the particulars of whether people are voting or not voting. We do lots of surveys on the site about, political activity, and people seem very excited about it, but ultimately, whether people are going to the booth or not, I'm not sure. I do think, though, that the thing that we should be talking about is not ultimately sort of whether people are spending too much time online or not, but whether there's a net gain if people are shifting from television to the net and then on the net connecting to other people.
Sherry Turkle, I want to thank you for starting that thread, but I want to toss it to Amy Jo Kim. All of this takes place really in the shadow of Robert Putnam's famous argument that we're bowling alone these days, that community life in this country, sort of affiliation, is eroding badly, that the places and the places we live, work, and gather in our real life aren't as important as they used to be, and he would say they should be, that we retreat into virtual world sort of to escape the pollution of the real one. Is there an offset here in your view?
Well, I just would go back to the first thing I said and to what Sherry said and what Omar said. I think that all of us are really pointing at the same trend, which is that it's the internet isn't this other thing. It is, when it started, when the well started, it was new and different. It was like going somewhere else. And what I'm seeing more and more, when I sense the other folks here are as well, is that it's really integrating into life just like the telephone. If you think back to when the telephone first got launched and became pervasive, people thought it was going to wreck all kinds of havoc, et cetera, et cetera. And you know what? The reality is sometimes I'm on the phone with my family in L.A. instead of talking to my neighbor to chat in the evenings. That's absolutely true. Does it mean I'm not connected? You know, that's a little bit of a value judgment. But what I see, and I see it accelerating right now, is really exactly what Omar just said and what Katie said, which is that people are blurring that boundary. People meet online and get together offline. People that know each other offline use the online medium to stay connected and to deepen their connections. I can tell you I have had more personal conversations with my youngest brother through email than I've ever had in real life. People, and Sherry can speak to this, you know, with great depth, people do reveal themselves when they find that funny combination of intimacy and anonymity, even though it's not really anonymous. It feels more anonymous online, and it brings out a different side of people. But I really think that it's integrated into our lives. To Robert Putnam's point, I certainly can't speak to, you know, is it really sucking voters from the booth? But I think people, my experience, my direct experience with lots and lots and lots of different online communities, business communities, you know, demographic communities, et cetera, is that the people are really making connections, and they're really using those connections to explode them out into their lives. And I see it very much as an accelerator of people's ability to both make connections and stay connected. And I think that the more the Internet gets integrated into our lives, when we have online voting, when, you know, it's really easy to respond to an email you sent on your computer by flipping up your cell phone, et cetera, I think that it will ultimately help to keep us connected. Whether
Amy Jo Kim, I think I'm with you. Not only on the connections among people, but I was going to say you meet a better class of people on the web. It's not that really. It's that you meet people at a more expressive level than in an awful lot of situations in our general lives. There's something very expressive, as Omar Wasa was saying. What was he saying? The point that people come alive in these exchanges that might not do it elsewhere. I want to ask Katie Hafner, as the author of The Well, who got this conversation started, just to sort of sum up how we'll all remember The Well's place in this history of a completely new way of gathering and revealing ourselves.
Well, I do hope people read the book because
that's the first step.
because we do tend to refer to The Well in the past tense, which is unfortunate because it's very much alive. It's a division now of Salon.com, which is having its own problems. And who knows, you know, whatever happens to Salon.com, who knows what will happen to The Well as well. But, obviously it's got us to thinking. It's served as a model for a lot of things. And I have to tell you, I have never been, as they say, I've always been on The Well, but not of The Well. So I'm not the best person to talk about what it's meant to me personally, but I know it's meant an awful lot to a lot of people who've been there.
Katie Hafner is a wonderful book. It's called The Well, A Story of Love, Death, and Real Life in the Seminole Online Community. Thank you, Katie Hafner. Thanks also to Amy Jo Kim, to Omar Wasow, Sherry Turkle, and Howard Rheingold. Thanks also to New England Streaming Media for audio streaming and to the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at the Harvard Law School. We had help today from Noel Flatt, Morgan Anderson, Jeremy Bowers, Beth Palmer, and Amy Kaplan. Our show is produced at the BM&P Studios at the Christian Science Monitor by Jake Shapiro, Amy McDonald, Dan First, Tom Tiger, Hitesh Hatti, and Catherine Bidwell. Our senior producer is Mary McGrath. I'm Christopher Lydon. Please visit us at www.christopherlydon.org. Thank you.